This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Witchwood Crown, A Last King of Austin Ard Story, by Tad Williams. Read for you by Andrew Wincott. Forward. Rider and mount glided down the slope through stands of kinswood trees, larches, shiny-leaved beeches, and oaks festooned with dangling catkins. Silent and surprising, the pair appeared first in one beam of bright sunlight, then another, at a speed that would have startled any merely mortal eye. The rider's pale cloak seemed to catch and reflect the colours all around, so that an idle or distracted glance would have seen only a hint of movement, imagined only wind. The warmth of the day pleased Tanahaya. The music of forest insects pleased her too, the whirring of grasshoppers and the hum of busy honeymakers. Even though the smell of the mortal habitation was strong, and this patch of forest only a momentary refuge, she spoke silent words of gratitude for an interlude of happiness.
"Praises, Mother Sun, praises for the growing scents, praise for the bees and their golden dance."
She was young by the standards of her people, with only a few centuries upon the broad earth. Tanahaya of Shiseron had spent many of those years in the saddle. First as messenger for her clan's leader, Himano of the Flowering Hills. Then later, after she had made her worth known to the House of Year Dancing, performing tasks for her friends in that clan. But this errand to the mortal's capital seemed as if it might be the most perilous of all her journeys, and was certainly the strangest. She hoped she was strong and clever enough to fulfill the trust of those who had sent her. Tanahaya had been described as wise beyond her years, but she still could not understand the importance her friends placed on the affairs of mortals, especially the short-lived creatures who inhabited this particular part of the world. That was even more inexplicable now, when it seemed clear to her that the Zedaya could no longer trust any mortals at all. Still, there was the castle she had been seeking, its highest roofs just visible through the trees. Looking at its squat towers and heavy stone walls, it was hard for Tanahaya to believe that Aswa, the greatest and most beautiful city of her people, had once stood here. Could anything of their old home be left in this pile of clumsy stone that men called the Hayholt?
"I must not think of what might be true, of what I fear, or what I hope."
Horse and rider moved down the slope.
"I must see only what is. Otherwise I fail my oath, and I fail my friends."
She stopped at the edge of the trees.
"Tsa, spider silk," she whispered,
and the horse stood in silence as Tanahaya listened. New noises wafted up the slope to her, as well as a new and not entirely welcome scent, the animal tang of unwashed mortals. Tanahaya clicked her tongue and spider silk stepped aside into shadow. She had a hand on the hilt of her sword when a golden-haired girl dashed into the sunlight, a basket of winter flowers swinging in one hand, daffodils and snowdrops and royal purple crocuses. Tanahaya's senses told her the child was not alone, so she stayed hidden in the shadows between trees as a half-dozen armed soldiers followed the child in gasping, clanking pursuit. After a moment, Tanahaya relaxed. It was clear the mortals did not mean to harm the little one. Still, she was surprised that mortal soldiers were so heedless of danger. She could have put arrows in most of them before they even realized they were not alone in the Kinswood. A mortal woman in a hat with a brim as wide as a wagon's wheel followed the armored men into the clearing.
"Lilia!"
the woman cried, then stopped and bent to catch her breath.
"Do not run, child! Oh, you are wicked! Wicked to make us chase you!"
The child stopped, eyes wide.
"But Auntie Rona, look! Berries!"
"Berries?
In Maris Month? You little mad thing.
The woman still trying to catch her breath was handsome by mortal standards, or so Tanahaya guessed, tall, with fine, strong bones in her face. By the name the child had given her, Tanahaya guessed this must be Countess Rona of Nad Glace, one of the mortal queen's closest friends. Tanahaya did not find it strange that a noble of high standing should be minding a child, though others might have.
No, you come back with me, honey lamb, the countess said. Those are owlberries, and they'll make you sick. No, they won't, the child declared, because they're forest berries, and forest berries have lots of magic. Fairy magic.
Magic. The woman in the hat sounded disgusted. But even from such a distance, Tanahaya's sharp eyes could see the smile that played across her face.
I'll give you fairy magic, Muharcha. You wanted to search for early flowers, and I brought you. We have been out for hours, and by Dianaha's spotless skirts, look at me. I am filthy and beprickled with nettles. They're not nettles, they're berry bushes, said the golden-haired girl. That's why they have thorns, so nobody will eat the berries. Nobody wants to eat those berries but birds. Not even the deer will go near them.
The heavily armored soldiers, still struggling for breath in their heavy mail, faces gleaming with sweat, began to straighten up. The girl had clearly led them a long, wearying chase over the hillside.
Should we grab her, your ladyship? Asked one.
The countess frowned.
Lilia, it is time to go back. I want my midday meal. I don't have to do anything unless you call me princess or your highness. What silliness! Your grandparents are away and I am your keeper, little lion cub. Come now, don't make me cross. I wish Uncle Timo was here. He lets me do things.
Uncle Timo is your sworn bondsman. No, he is your helpless slave, and lets you get away with everything. I am made of harder stuff. Come along. The girl called Lilia looked from the countess to all the dark bushes full of pale, blue-white fruit, then sighed and slowly walked back down the slope. If its handle had been any longer, her basket would have dragged in the loamy soil.
When Queen Grandmother and King Grandfather come back, I'm going to tell on you, she warned. Tell what?
The countess frowned.
That I wouldn't let you run away by yourself in the forest, to be eaten by wolves and bears? I could give them berries. Then they wouldn't eat me.
The woman took her hand.
Even hungry bears won't eat owlberries, and the wolves would rather eat you.
As the small party vanished back down the deer trail, into a thick copse of oak and ash trees farther down the slope, Tanahaya watched with a kind of wonder. To think that little creature named Lilia would reach womanhood, perhaps marry and become a mother and grandmother, grow old and even die, all in not much more than one of her people's great years. It seemed to Tanahaya that being mortal must be like trying to live a full life, in the space between falling from a high place and hitting the ground, a rush through wind and confusion to death. How did the poor creatures manage? For the first time it occurred to Tanahaya of Shiseron that perhaps she might learn something from this task. It was an unexpected thought. So this young creature was Lilia, she told herself, the granddaughter of Queen Miriamel and King Seoman, the objects of Tanahaya's embassy. She would be seeing that proud little bumblebee of a girl again.
Bumblebee? No, butterfly, she thought with a sudden pang. A flash of color and glory beneath the sky. And then, like all mortals, too soon she will become dust.
But if the fears of Tanahaya's friends proved accurate, she knew, then the end for that butterfly child and all the rest of the Hayholt's mortals. might come even sooner than any of them could guess. As she reined up again to examine the castle, she could still hear the faint rattle of the retreating soldiers, and the golden girl's voice, no words now but just a musical burble rising from the forest below. The wind changed, and the stink of mortals, of unwashed bodies and unchanged garments, abruptly deepened. It was all she could do not to turn around and retreat. She would have to accustom herself, she knew. Tanahaya had never liked the squat, cheerless look of men's buildings, any more than she cared for men's odor. And the Hayholt, this great castle of theirs, was no different. Despite its size, it seemed nothing more than a collection of carelessly built dwellings, hiding behind brutish stone walls. One wall set inside another, like a succession of mushroom rings. The entire awkward structure perched on a high headland, above the wide bay known as Kinsla, as though it were the nest of some slovenly seabird. Even the red tiles that roofed many of the buildings seemed dull to her as dried blood. And Tanahaya thought the famous castle looked more like a place to be imprisoned than anything else. It was astounding to realize that a few mortal decades earlier, an eye blink of time to her people, the Storm King's attack on the living had ended just here, only moments from success. She thought she could still hear the great crying out of that day, and feel the countless shadows that would not disperse, the torment and terror of so many. Even time itself had almost been overthrown here. How could the mortals continue to live in such a place? Could they not feel the uneasy dead all around them? Watching the girl had brought her a moment of good cheer, but now it blew away like dust on a hot, dry wind. For a moment, Tanahaya's hand strayed to the witness in her belt pouch, the sacred, time-worn mirror that would allow her to speak across great earthly distances to those who had sent her. She didn't belong here. It was hard to believe that any of her race could in these fallen times. It was not too late, after all. She could beg her loved ones in Shao E Tenokai to find someone else for this task. Tanahaya's impulse did not last. It was not her place to judge these short-lived creatures, but to do what she had been bid for the good of her own people.
After all, she reminded herself, a year does not dance itself into being. Everything is sacrifice.
She lifted her hand from the hidden mirror and caught up the reins once more. Even from this distance, the stench of mortals seemed unbearably strong, so fierce she could barely stand it. How much worse would it be when she was out of the heights and riding through their cramped streets? Something struck her hard in the back. Tanahaya gasped, but could not get her breath. She tried to turn to see what had hit her, simultaneously reaching to draw her sword, but before it cleared the scabbard, another arrow struck her, this time in the chest. The Sither tried to crouch low in the saddle, but that only pressed the second arrow more agonizingly into her body. She could feel something like a cool breath on her back, and knew it must be blood soaking her jerkin. She reached down and broke the second shaft off close to her ribs. Free of that obstruction, but still pulsing blood around the broken shaft, she threw herself against Spider Silk's neck and clung tightly, aiming now only for escape. But even as she clapped her heels against the horse's side, a new arrow hissed into the animal's neck, just a handspan from Tanahaya's fingers. The horse reared, shrilling in pain and terror. As Tanahaya struggled to hang on, a fourth arrow took her high in her back and spun her out of the saddle. She fell into air, and for a mad moment it seemed almost like flight. Then something struck her all over, and at once, a great, flat blow and a soundless darkness rushed over her like a river. Part 1. widows. Locusts laid their eggs in the corpse of a soldier. When the worms were mature, they took wing. Their drone was ominous, their shells hard. Anyone could tell they had hatched from an unsatisfied anger. They flew swiftly toward the north. They hid the sky like a curtain. When the wife of the soldier saw them, she turned pale. Her breath failed her. She knew he was dead in battle, his corpse lost in the desert. That night she dreamed she rode a white horse, so swift it left no footprints, and came to where he lay in the sand. She looked at his face, eaten by the locusts, and tears of blood filled her eyes. Ever after, she would not let her children injure any insect that might have fed on the dead. She would lift her face to the sky and say, "O locusts, if you are seeking a place to winter, you can find shelter in my heart." Su Chao, the locust swarm. 1. The Glorious. The pavilion walls billowed and snapped as the winds rose. Tiamak thought it was like being inside a large drum. Many people in the tent were trying to be heard, but the clear voice of a young minstrel floated above it all, singing a song of heroism. "Sing ye loud his royal name, Siomen the Glorious. Spread it far, his royal fame, Siomen the Glorious." The king did not look glorious. He looked tired. Tiamak could see it in the lines of Simon's face, the way his shoulders hunched, as if he awaited a blow. But that blow had already fallen. Today was only the grim anniversary. Limping more than usual because of the cold day, little Tiamak made his way among all the larger men. These courtiers and important officials were gathered around the king, who sat on one of two high-backed wooden chairs at the center of the tent, both draped in the royal colors. A banner with the twin drakes, the red and the white, hung above them. The other chair was empty. As a makeshift throne room in the middle of a Hernesteer field, Tiamak thought it was more than adequate. But it was also clearly the one place King Siomen did not want to be. Not today. With Hero's sword in his right hand, and naught but courage in his heart, did Siomen make his gallant stand, though cowards fled apart. When the hell-spawned Norns did bring foul war upon the innocent, and giants beat upon the gates, and Norn sails filled the Glenywent. "I don't understand," said the king loudly to one of the courtiers. "In truth, my good man, I haven't understood a thing you said, what with all this shouting and caterwauling. Why should they have to lime the bridges? Do they think we are birds that need catching?" "Line the bridges, sire." The king scowled. "I know, Sir Murtagh, it was meant as a jest. But it still doesn't make any sense." The courtier's determined smile faltered. "It is the tradition for the people to line up along the bridges as well as the roads. But King Hugh is concerned that the bridges might not stand under the weight of so many." "And so we must give up our wagons and come on foot? All of us?" Sir Murtagh flinched. "It is what King Hugh requests, Your Majesty." When armies of the Stormlord came upon the very Swertcliff plain, who stood on Hayholt's battlements and bade them all turn back again? "Sing ye loud his royal name, Siomen the Glorious. Spread it far, his royal fame, Siomen the Glorious." King Simon's head had tipped to one side. It was not the side from which he was being urgently addressed by another messenger, who had finally worked his way to a place beside the makeshift throne. Something had distracted Simon. Tiamak thought that seeing the king's temper fray was like watching a swamp flatboat beginning to draw water. It was plain that if someone didn't do something soon, the whole craft would sink. He slew the dragon fierce and cold, and banished winter by his hand. He tamed the Scythi proud and old, and saved the blighted, threatened land. Murtagh was still talking in one royal ear, and the other messenger had started his speech for the third time, when Simon suddenly stood. The courtiers fell back swiftly, like hunting hounds when the bear turns at bay. The king's beard was still partly red, but he had enough grey in it now, as well as the broad white stripe where he had once been splashed by dragon's blood, that when his anger was up he looked a bit like an Aedanite prophet from the old days.
That! Simon shouted. It's bad enough that I cannot hear myself think, that every man in camp wants me to do something, or not do something. But must I listen to such terrible lies and exaggerations as well?
He turned and pointed his finger at the miscreant.
Well, must I?
At the far end of the king's finger, the young minstrel stared back, with the round eyes of a quiet nighttime grazer caught in the sudden glare of a torch. He swallowed. It seemed to take a long time.
Beg pardon, Majesty? He squeaked.
That song! That preposterous song! He slew the dragon fierce and cold. A palpable lie!
The king strode forward until he towered over the thin, dark-haired singer, who seemed to be melting and shrinking like a snowflake caught in a warm hand.
By the bloody tree, I never killed that dragon. I just wounded it a bit. I was terrified. And I didn't tame the Scythi either for the love of our Lord Eucerius.
The minstrel looked up at him, mouth working but without sound. And the rest of the song is even more mad.
Banish the winter? You might as well say I make the sun rise every day.
But it is only a song, Majesty,
the minstrel finally said.
It is a well-known and well-loved one. All the people sing it.
But Simon was no longer shouting. His anger was like a swift storm. The thunder had boomed. Now all that was left was cold rain.
Then go sing it to all the people.
Or better yet, when we return to the Hayhold, ask old Sangfugal what really happened.
Ask him what it was truly like when the Storm King's darkness came down on us and we all pissed ourselves in fear.
A moment of confused bravery showed itself on the young man's face.
But it was Sangfugal who made that song, Your Majesty, and he was the one who taught it to me.
Simon growled.
So, then all bards are liars. Go on, boy. Get away from me.
The minstrel looked quite forlorn as he pushed his way toward the door of the pavilion. Tiamat caught at his sleeve as he went by.
Wait outside, he told the singer. Wait for me.
The young man was so full of anguish he had not truly heard.
I beg pardon?
Just wait outside for a few moments. I will come for you.
The youth looked at the little Rannaman oddly, but everyone in the court knew Tiamat and how close he was to the king and queen. The harper blinked his eyes, doing his best to compose himself.
If you say so, my lord.
Simon was already driving the rest of the courtiers from the pavilion.
Enough! Leave me be now, all of you! I cannot do everything, and certainly not in one day. Give me peace.
Tiamat waited until the wave of humanity had swept past him and out of the tent. Then he waited a bit longer, until the king finished pacing and dropped back onto his chair. Simon looked up at his counselor, and his face sagged with unhappiness and useless anger.
Don't look at me that way, Tiamat.
The king seldom lost his temper with those who served him, and was much loved for it. Back home in Erkinland, many called him the Commoner King, or even the Scullion King, because of his youthful days as a Hayholt dog's body. Generally, Simon remembered very well indeed what it felt like to be ignored or blamed by those with power. But sometimes, especially when he was in the grip of such heartache as he was today, he fell into foul moods. Tiamak, of course, knew that the moods seldom lasted long, and were followed quickly by regret.
"I am not looking at you in any particular way, Majesty. Don't mock me. You are. It's that sad, wise expression you put on when you're thinking about what a dunderhead one of your monarchs is. And that monarch is nearly always me. You need rest, Majesty."
It was a privilege to speak as old friends, one that Tiamak would never have presumed on with others in the room.
"You are weary, and your temper is short."
The king opened his mouth, then shook his head.
"This is a bad day," he said at last. "A very bad day. Where is Miriam now?"
"The queen declined any audiences today. She is out walking."
"I am glad for her. I hope she is being left alone."
"As much as she wishes to be. Her ladies are with her. She likes company more than you do on days like this."
"Days like this, I would like to be on the top of a mountain in the Trollfells with Binnabik and his folk, with nothing but snow to look at, and nothing but wind to hear."
"We have plenty of wind for you here in this meadow," Tiamak said. "But not too much snow, considering that there is still almost a fortnight of winter left."
"Oh, I know what day it is, what month," Simon said. "I need no reminding."
Tiamak cleared his throat.
"Of course not. But will you take my advice? Rest yourself for a while. Let your unhappiness cool."
"It was just hearing that nonsense over and over. Simon the hero, all of that. I did not seem such a hero when my son—"
"Please, Majesty.
But I should not have taken it out on the harbor."
Again the storm had blown over quickly, and now Simon was shaking his head.
"He has given me many a sweet hour of song before. It is not his fault that lies become history so quickly. Perhaps I should tell him that I was unfair, and I am sorry."
Tiamak hid his smile. A king who apologized? No wonder he was tied to his two monarchs with bonds stronger than iron.
"I will confess, it was not like you, Majesty."
"Well, find him for me, would you?"
"In truth, I think he is just outside the tent, Majesty."
"Oh, for the love of St. Tunnath and St. Riap, Tiamak, would you please stop calling me Majesty when we're alone?"
"You said he was nearby?"
"I'll go see, Simon."
The minstrel was indeed near, cowering from the brisk Maris winds in a fold of tent wall beside the doorway. He followed Tiamak back into the pavilion like a man expecting a death sentence.
"There you are," the king said. "Come. Your name is Renan, yes?"
The eyes, already wide, grew wider still.
"Yes, Majesty."
"I was harsh to you, Renan. Today, I am not a happy man today."
Tiamak thought that the harper, like everyone else in the royal court, knew only too well what day it was, but was wise enough to stay quiet while the king struggled to find words.
"In any case, I am sorry for it," the king said. "Come back to me tomorrow, and I will be in a better humor for songs. But have that old scoundrel Sangfugl teach you a few lays that at least approach the truth, if not actually wrestle with it."
"Yes, sire."
"Go on, then. You have a fine voice. Remember that music is a noble charge, even a dangerous charge, because it can pierce a man's heart
when a spear or arrow cannot. As the young man hurried out of the pavilion, Simon looked up at his old friend. I suppose now I must bring back all the others and make amends to them as well.
I see no reason why you should, Tiamat told him. You have already given them all the hours since you broke your fast. I think it might be good for you to eat and rest.
But I have to reply to King Hugh and his damned suggestions, as he calls them. Simon tugged at his beard. What is he about, Tiamat? You would think with all these nonsensical conditions he would rather not have us come to Hnisadak at all. Does he resent having to feed and house even this fairly small royal progress?
Oh, I'm sure that's not so. The Hernisdiri are always finicky with their rituals.
But secretly, Tiamat did not like it either. It was one thing to insist on proper arrangements, another thing to keep the High King and High Queen waiting in a field for 2 days over issues of ceremony that should have been settled weeks ago. After all, the King of Hernisdir would not have a throne at all, were it not for the High Ward that Simon and Miriamel represented. Hernisdir only had a king because Miri's grandfather, King John, had permitted it under his own overarching rule. Still, Tiamat thought, Hugh was a comparatively young king. Perhaps this rudeness was nothing more than a new monarch's inexperience.
I am certain Sir Murtagh, Count Eolair, and I will have everything set to rights soon, he said aloud.
Well, I hope you're right, Tiamat. Tell them we agree to everything and to send us the bedamned invitation tomorrow morning. It's a sad errand that brings us this way in the first place, and today is a sad anniversary. It seems pointless to dicker about such things. How many banners, how high the thrones, the procession route. He wagged his hand in disgust.
If Hugh wishes to make himself look important, let him. He can act like a child if he wants, but Miri and I don't need to. You may be doing the King of Hernisdir a disservice, said Tiamat mildly.
But in his heart of hearts, he didn't think so. He truly didn't think so.
Can we swim in it, Papa?
The Black River was fast and silent.
I don't think so, son. And what's on the other side?
The child asked.
Nobody knows.
It was a mixture of Simon's dreams and memories, made partly from the time he had taken young John Joshua down to Grenburn town, near the river, to see the flooding. In the wake of the Storm King's defeat, the winters had grown warmer, and in the years after the fall of the tower, spring thaws had swollen the rivers of Erkinland, until they overflowed their banks, turning fields on both sides of the Glenewent into a great plain of water, with islands of floating debris that had once been houses and barns. John Joshua had been nearly 5 years of age when Simon took him to Grenburn, and full of questions. Not that he had ever stopped being full of questions.
"Don't cross the river, Papa,"
his dream son told him.
"I won't."
Simon didn't laugh, but in life he had, amused by the boy's solemn warning.
"It's too wide, John Joshua. I'm a grown man, but I don't think I could swim so far."
He pointed to the far side, a place where the fields were higher. It was farther than Simon could have shot an arrow.
"If I went across, would you come after me?"
the child asked.
"Or if I fell in?"
"Of course,"
he remembered saying it with such certainty.
"I would jump in and pull you out. Of course I would."
But something was distracting him, some dream noise that he knew he should ignore. But it was hard not to notice the hard-edged baying of hounds. All his life since the weird white storm spike pack had chased him, Simon had found that the noise of howling dogs chilled his blood.
Papa?
The boy sounded farther away than he had a moment before, but Simon had turned his back on the river to look out across fields that were darkening as the sun disappeared behind the clouds. Somewhere in the distance, a shape moved across the ground. But it moved like a single thing. No hunting pack, but a single hunting thing.
Papa?
So faint. And the little prince was no longer holding his hand. How had that happened? Even though it was only a dream, though Simon half knew he was in bed and sleeping, he felt a dreadful cold terror rush through him, as if the very blood was freezing in his brains. His son was no longer beside him. He looked around wildly, but at first saw nothing. In the distance, the mournful scraping noise of the hounds grew louder. Then he saw the little head bobbing on the dark river, the small hands lifted as if to greet some friend, a false friend, a lying friend. And his heart shuddered as though it would stop. He ran. He was running. He had been running forever, but still he came no closer. The clouds thickened overhead, and the sunlight all but vanished. He thought he could hear a terrible thin cry and the sound of splashing. But although he threw himself toward the place he had last seen the child, he could get no closer. He screamed then and leaped, as if he could cross all that uncrossable difference by the sheer strength of his need, of his regret.
Simon!
A cool hand was on his forehead, not so much soothing him as holding him back, prisoning him. For a moment, he was so maddened with terror that he reached up to strike the obstacle out of his way. Then he heard her gasp, surprised by his sudden movement, and he remembered where he was.
Mary? A bad dream, Simon. You're having a bad dream.
When she felt his muscles unknot, she took her hand from his head. She also had an arm around his chest, which she loosed before letting herself back down beside him in the disordered bed. "Shall I call for someone to bring you something?" He shook his head, but of course she couldn't see him.
"No, I'll..." "Was it the same dream as last time? The dragon?"
"No, it was about John Joshua when he was little." "Of course. I haven't been able to think of anything else for days." Simon lay staring up into the darkness for a long time. He could tell by her breathing she had not gone back to sleep either.
"I dreamed of him," he said at last.
"He got away from me. I chased him, but I couldn't reach him." She still didn't speak, but she put her hand against his cheek and left it there. 7 years gone, Mary. 7 years since that cursed fever took him. And still I can't stop."
She stirred. "Do you think it is any different for me? I miss him every moment."
He could tell by her voice that she was angry, although he did not know exactly why. How could the priests say that death came as the great friend, when instead it came like an army, taking what it wished and destroying peace even years after it had withdrawn?
"I know, dear one, I know."
After a while she said,
"And think, we have the 9th of Maris every year from now until the end of time. It was such a happy day once, when he was born."
"It still should be, my dear wife. God takes everyone back. But our son gave us an heir before we lost him. He gave us a great deal."
"An heir?"
The edge in her voice was brittle.
"All I want is him. All I want is John Joshua. Instead, we are lumbered with her for the rest of our lives."
"You said yourself that the widow is a small price to pay for our granddaughter, not to mention our grandson and heir."
"I said that before Morgan became a young man."
"Ha!" Simon wasn't actually amused, but it was better than cursing. "Scarcely a man yet." Miriamel took a careful breath before speaking.
Our grandson is 17 years old, much the same age that you were when we were first wed. Man enough to be taking his fill of the ladies, man enough to spend his days drinking and dicing and doing whatever takes his fancy. You did not do the same at that age.
I was washing dishes and peeling potatoes and onions and sweeping the castle, my dear, but not by choice. And then I fought for Joshua, but that was not really by choice either.
Still, with ne'er-do-well companions like the ones he has, how will Morgan grow? He will bend to their shape.
He will grow out of this foolishness, Mary. He must.
But Simon didn't entirely believe it. Their living grandson sometimes seemed as lost to him as the son who had been swept away into the black river of death. After another silent time in the dark, she said,
"And I miss our little one, too. I mean our granddaughter."
Miriamelle put her arm across her husband's belly, moving closer. He could feel the tightness in her muscles.
"I wish we hadn't left her home. Do you think she's being good for Rona?"
"Never." He actually laughed a little. "You worry too much, my love. You know we could not bring Lilia. It's still winter in Rimmersgard, and the air will be full of ice and fever. We brought the grandchild who would benefit from being with us."
"Benefit? How could anyone who has already lost a parent benefit from watching a good old man die?"
"Prince Morgan needs to learn that he is not just himself. He is the hope of many people."
Simon felt sleep pulling at him again, finally. "As are you and I, my wife." He meant it kindly, but he felt her stiffen again.
"I must sleep. You too. Don't lie there and fret, Mary. Come closer. Put your head on my chest. There."
Sometimes, especially when she was unhappy, he missed her badly, even though she was only a short distance away. Just as she began to settle her head on his chest, she stiffened.
"His grave," she whispered. "We didn't."
Simon stroked her hair.
"We did. Or at least Passavalles promised in his last letter that he would take flowers. And also that he would make certain Archbishop Gervis performs John Joshua's Mansa."
"Ah."
He felt her stiff muscles loosen.
"Passavalles is a good man. We're lucky to have him."
"We are indeed. Now, we should both sleep, Mary. It will be a busy day tomorrow."
"Why? Is Hugh finally going to let us in?"
"It better. I'm losing my patience."
"I never liked him. Not from the first."
"Yes, but you don't like many people at the first, dear one."
He let his head roll sideways until it touched hers.
"That's not true. I used to."
She pushed a little closer. The wind was rising again, making the tent ropes hum outside.
"I had more love in me, I think. Sometimes now, I fear I have used it all."
"Except for me and your grandchildren, yes."
She waited an instant too long for Simon's liking.
"Of course,"
she said.
"Of course."
But this anniversary had always been blighted since their son had died. Small wonder that she was bitter. Somewhere during the wind's song, Simon fell asleep again.
2. The Finest Tent on the Frost March. He had been following his father for a long time, it seemed, although he did not remember when or where they had begun. The sky had grown dark, and the familiar tall shape was only a shadow in front of him now, sometimes barely visible as the path twisted through the deepening twilight.
He wished he wasn't too old to hold his father's hand. Or was he? He did not know how old he was.
"Papa! Wait!" he cried.
His father said something, but Morgan couldn't understand him. Something seemed to be muffling his father's voice. Doors or distance or simply distraction. He hurried after, out of breath, short legs aching, trying not to notice the sounds in the trees that seemed to follow him. The strange voices hooting as softly as the ghosts of doves. Where was this place? How had they come here? So many trees. Were they in the forest of grandfather's stories? That dark, unknowable place full of odd sounds and watching eyes.
Papa?
He raised his voice almost to a scream.
Where are you? Wait for me!
The trees were everywhere, and the moonlight was so faint that he could hardly see the path. As he hurried around each bend in pursuit of his father's ever-dwindling figure, the roots seemed to writhe in the mud beneath his feet, like moon-silvery snakes, grabbing at him and tripping him. Several times he stumbled and nearly fell, but forced himself on. The entire forest seemed to be twisting around him now, the trees spinning and drooping like exhausted dancers. He stopped to listen, but heard only the ghastly, breathless hoots from above.
"Papa! Where did you go? Come back!"
He thought he heard his father's measured voice float back to him from somewhere far ahead, but he could not tell if he was saying, "I'm here," or "I fear." But fathers were never afraid. They stayed with you. They protected you. They weren't afraid themselves.
"Papa?"
The path was gone. He could feel the roots moving beneath his feet as the branches reached down to enfold him and smother the light.
"Papa! Don't leave me!"
He was alone, abandoned and crying. He was just another orphan, a stray.
"Papa!"
No answer. Never an answer. He fought to get free, but the trees still clung. It was the same every time. Morgan, Prince of Erkinland, and heir to the high throne of Prester John's empire, tumbled off his cot and onto the ground, fighting with the cloak that tangled him. Half lost in the dream forest, he lay for long moments on the damp rugs, his heart thundering in his chest. At last he sat up, trying to make sense of where he was and what had happened. He was cold, even with the blanket still clinging to his neck, like a spurned lover, and something nearby was making a nasty, rasping noise. Morgan peered worriedly into the darkness, but after a moment realized the sound was only the snoring of his squire, Melkin.
"Well, praise be to God that somebody can sleep."
Memory came slouching back. He was on the royal progress with his grandfather and grandmother. He and Melkin were in his tent in the middle of some field outside Hernisadark, the capital. And it was cold because spring was still a fortnight away. Tonight there had been a meal and too much talk. Also too much wine, although now he was wishing he had drunk more of it. A great deal more, to chase the chill from his bones, the deep, feverish body cold of another foul dream. His eyes were wet, he realized, his cheeks damp. He had been crying in his sleep.
"Papa! I couldn't catch up to him."
There seemed to be a hole where his heart should be, as though the wind were blowing right through him. Angry, he wiped his face with his sleeve.
"Weeping like a child. Idiot. Coward. What if someone saw me?"
Wine was what he needed. Morgan knew from experience that a large cup of sour, reliable red would warm the cold hole in his vitals and push the dream out of his thoughts. But he had no wine. He had drunk all that had been offered while he dined with the king and queen.
but it hadn't been enough to give him a dreamless night. For a moment he considered simply trying to go back to sleep. The wind was blowing chill outside, and the camp was full of people who would gladly scurry to his grandparents with the tale, if they saw him out staggering around at this hour of the night. But the memory of that endless forest track, of the horror of never being able to catch up to his father, was too much.
Wine!
Yes, it would be good to hear the foolish arguments of his friends, an ordinary reassuring thing. And it would be even better to be drunk again. Drunk enough this time that he would not hear the voices in the forest, would not feel the chill of being left behind, perhaps would not even dream. Morgan dragged himself to his feet and pushed his way out of the tent, in search of accommodating oblivion. He had a good idea of where to look. No royal proclamation or official announcement of any kind designated the tent shared by the Nabonne knights Sir Astrian and Sir Olveris as the home of the makeshift tavern. The presence of seasoned drinker Sir Porto and a reasonable constant supply of wine was enough. The sprawling royal camp was dark, but a pair of lanterns made the tent seem nearly festive. Old Sir Porto stared down into his cup and nodded.
"Bless us when we are weak, O Lord," he said in his most doleful tones. "And save some blessings, if you please, because soon we will be weak again."
He took a long swallow, then wiped his damp mouth and scruffy white beard with the back of his hand.
"That is the last," he said. "God be kind. What I wouldn't give for a little of that red stuff from an estrus they keep back at the maid. A man's vintage, that is. This grape water is scarcely old enough to know of the existence of sin."
"One does not need to know about sin to enjoy it," said Sir Astrian.
"Please, my lord,"
said the young woman on Astrian's lap. She was struggling hard to stand, but having no success.
"I will be punished if I don't get back to my work. Let me go."
Astrian did not loosen his grip and kept her on his knee with small adjustments of balance.
"What?" he demanded. "Would you return to the shocking boredom of the ostler's wagons?"
He reached up and pulled at the girl's bodice until her bosom threatened to overspill.
"My lord!"
She snatched to hold up the fabric, and his hands unchecked strayed elsewhere. The tent flap jiggled but did not open. Something good-sized was caught in it, and the poles of the tent swayed as though in a gale.
"The air to all the lands of Austin Ard appears to be tangled," said Sir Astrian. "Somebody set him free and be rewarded with a sizable estate."
"I will give you a sizable boot in your ass," said the voice, whose owner was writhing in the flap like a butterfly trying to escape its cocoon. "As soon as I find you..."
"Someone go to our noble prince's aid. Make haste," cried Astrian. "I would myself, but at the moment I am engaged in fierce battle."
He finally managed to pull down hard enough to overcome the young woman's resistance, and her bare breasts sprang into view. Instead of surrendering and trying to cover herself, though, the girl redoubled her efforts to escape, cursing and flailing.
The bubs," sang Sir Astrian. The bubs, in our Nabonne did ring. On the day they hanged our Redeemer, though no hands did pull the cord, the bubs in every tower told to prove Aidan our lord."
With help from dour black-haired Sir Olveris, Prince Morgan finally emerged from the tent flap. Morgan's hair, a shade too brown for golden, clung in strands across his face, damp with melting snowflakes. His brows, a shade darker and thicker than his hair, rose in slow, slightly distracted dismay as he saw the serving girl fighting to free herself.
"God's eyes, Astrian! What are you doing? Let the poor girl go, and someone pour me a cup of something strong.
He looked around.
What? No succor for your lord? I call you traitors.
We have finished the last, Highness, said Porto, guiltily wiping his upper lip. The place is as dry as the dunes of Nescadu.
God curse it!
Morgan seemed genuinely upset.
Nothing to drown a night of foul dreams? Ah, well. Distract me then, Astrian. You owe me another game, and I am ready to take my money back. And this time, we are not using your dice, you cunning near dwarf.
Cruel words, said Astrian, grinning. The ostler's maid was still trying to get off his lap and looked ready to weep.
I am not the tallest man in this kingdom, true, but I am not so low as you make me. My head reaches Alvarez's neck, and since there is nothing of much use above that point, he and I are as good as even.
Sweet Aiden.
Morgan lowered himself carefully onto a wooden stool, scowling ferociously.
Are you still mauling her? I said let the girl go, Astrian. If she doesn't want to be here, let her be on her way.
He kicked at Astrian's leg, then folded away his frown to show the young woman a smile, made slightly less courtly by the extreme redness of his face.
He begs your pardon, lass.
Of course I do, my prince.
Astrian released his prey just as she was straining away from him, so that she would have fallen to the ground if Alvarez had not caught her and held her up until she gained her balance. The tall knight said nothing, as was his wont, but rolled his eyes at Astrian as he returned to his own seat atop a wooden chest.
My apologies for Sir Astrian, Morgan said to the girl. He is a rude fellow. And what is your name, my dear?
She was as red-faced with exertion as the prince was with drink, and her eyes were wide as a frightened horse's. But when she had pushed herself back into her bodice, she did her best to curtsy to Morgan.
Thank you, your highness. I am Goda, and I only came here to tell these men that Lord Jeremias said they were to have no more wine. As it is, he said, they have already drunk much of what was meant for the return journey.
Despite the angry force of her words, she was near tears.
It is a good thing that there will be mead in her Nisadak, then.
Morgan waved permission for her to go. She lifted her skirts and almost ran from the tent.
If they ever let us into the city.
Porto's voice was doleful as a funeral bell.
Soon, we will die of thirst here in this field.
I must say, Highness, Astrian said,
you look as though you've already found a bit of something to ease this sad journey. Did you bring it back to share with your brothers of the road?
Share? Morgan shook his head. I had to spend the longest evening of my life at the royal table with my grandmother and grandfather, having my sins and yours, that is, listed for me in exquisite detail. Then I tried to sleep, and...
He scowled and waved the idea away with his hand.
It matters not. I deserved every drop I could guzzle, and it was still nowhere near enough.
He sighed.
Still, if there's nothing left to drink, we might as well gamble.
With the young woman now long gone, Morgan let himself slump, revealing what he truly was, a very young man who had drunk too much.
So you bring us nothing, Highness? Asked Porto.
I swallowed everything I could reach at my grandparents' table, but it wasn't enough. No. They all just kept talking. And it was about nothing. The bloody Hernisteri king and the royal blacksmith's need for scrap to turn into horse nails and the complaints of the local Hernisteri farmers that their lands are being pillaged by the royal progress. And after putting up with that all evening, I'm beginning to be sober again. I do not favor sobriety.
He looked to Astrian.
By the way, speaking of pillagers, I cannot help noticing a haunch of something on the spit over your fire. It looks rather like the remains of a fat farm pig.
No, a free wild boar of the hills, Highness,
Astrian said.
Isn't that right, Porto? He led us a fierce chase.
Porto looked more than a bit shamefaced.
Oh, aye, he did.
All over his pen, I have no doubt, Morgan frowned.
God save us, the boredom.
But the prince looked more haunted than bored.
Oh, and there was a messenger arrived from Elvrit's Hala, right in the middle of it all. The Rimmer's men beg us to make good speed after we leave Ernestia. It seems the Duke is not dead yet.
But those are excellent tidings, said Porto, sitting a little straighter. All this Grimnor still lives? Excellent news.
Yes, huzzah, I suppose.
Morgan gave Astrian a hard look.
Why are we not dicing, fellow? Why is my money still in your pocket?
My lord, said Porto, I do not mean to scold, but Duke Isgrimnor has been one of your grandparents' greatest allies. I fought with him for the Hayholt more than 30 years ago. And again at the cursed Nakiga gate. You still call it fighting?
Astrian smirked.
I believe the name for what you did was hiding.
Porto scowled.
My dignity does not allow me to respond to such wretched untruths. Were you there, sir? No. You were a mere imp of a child then, vexing your nursemaid, while I was risking my life against the Norns.
Astrian's loud laugh was his only reply. Porto struggled to his feet, scraping his head against the top of the tent. It was said that of all the knights who had ever fought to uphold the High Ward, only the great Camaris had been taller than Porto. However, that was where the comparison ceased.
What is this, then? Laughter?
The old soldier demanded.
Shall I call you Sir Mockery? What is this?
He pulled a pendant out of his collar, a smooth female shape carved in rounded blue crystal.
Did I not take this from one of the fairies after I slew him? This is Norn stuff, the true article. Go ahead, mock. You have no such prize.
Sir Olveris said,
I doubt not that you took it from one who was face down and dying, old man, and then finished him off with your sword in his back.
Prince Morgan jumped in surprise.
By the bloody tree, Olveris! You are silent so long, then you speak from the shadows without warning. I thought for a moment we were haunted.
The black-haired man did not reply. He had exhausted himself with such a long speech.
Enough with tormenting Porto, the prince said. Come now, Astrian. Is it to be Caster's Call or Herka? I will not let this day end without some good result, and beggaring you would make me very happy. I have not had a good day with the bones since we crossed the border into Hernestia.
There are no borders out here,
said Astrian, as he gave the prince's dice a good long look, weighing them on his palm, and then letting his fingers probe the pips for boar's bristles or painted lead.
These will do,
he said, handing them back.
What do you mean by that nonsense? The prince asked. No borders?
He rolled his first number.
A 10, sir, 2 hands. You may bid as you explain your remark.
It is only this, Highness, said Astrian. We crossed into Hernestia days ago. Remesgard is still 20 leagues away. Who do you suppose lives in Ballydun, the walled city just to the east?
Morgan shrugged, watching Astrian make his point with a 6 and a 4. Everything the knight did had a compact grace to it, most definitely including his use of a sword, where his speed and nimbleness more than made up for his small stature. He was frequently named, and not least by himself, one of the best swordsmen in any land.
Hernesteermen, I suppose, Morgan said. Knights, nobles, peasants, all the regular sorts of people.
Rimmersmen, your highness. They settled there after some war hundreds of years ago and never moved again. Most of the folk there are of northern blood.
Now it was Astrian's turn, and he immediately rolled stones, ballocks, as soldiers termed it, a pair of ones. He swept the small pot from the chest serving as a table.
I do like your dice, my prince. Now, did you notice that village we passed this morning? Not that you looked as if you were seeing much.
My head was pounding and ringing like your damn Navanay bells. Yes, I suppose I saw it. Some children and others came out to wave at us, yes?
Exactly. And do you know what language they speak there?
No. By the eternal Aiden, how would I know that?
They speak Hernesthiri, of course. We are in Hernesthir, after all.
Astrian grinned.
But their blood is that of Erkinland, just like yours. And there are many Erkinlandish words in their speech. Do you see?
Do I see what?
Morgan had lost the second throw as well, and his improved mood was beginning to fail again.
That nobody here seems to know what language they should speak? Splutty tree, man, how is that my concern?
Because it shows that borders are nonsense, at least most of the time. There are a few, such as the boundaries between northern Rimmersgard and the Nornfells, that means something real, because they are fiercely defended on both sides. But here on the Frost March, all are mixed up together. Hernesthiri, Rimmersmen, Erkinlanders. The people here speak a jumble of different tongues. They remember feuds that go back hundreds of years. But they speak in a way that would make their ancestors see blood before their eyes.
Do not jest about the Nornfells, said Saporto.
You were not there at Nakiga. You did not see those things, or hear them singing with voices like sweet children, even as they killed and died.
I do not jest at all, said Astrian.
God grant the white foxes stay in the north where they belong, but the rest of the peoples of Ostenard are mixing like the wax of different colored candles, melted and swirled together. Soon, there will be no difference between a Rimmersman and a Hernesthirman, or between a Nabonay lord and a Thrithings barbarian. That is the curse of peace.
Peace is no curse, said old Porto.
I would love to do some deeds worthy of a prince, said Morgan sadly, as he watched another pile of coins disappear into Astrian's purse. Not a large war, perhaps, but it has been more than a score of years since we fought the Thrithings men, and I see no threat to hope for. It is a bad time to be young.
Porto would say it is never a bad time to be young, said Alvarez from the back of the tent. He would also say it is never a good time to be old. I can speak for myself, sir, said the tall knight. I am not so ancient nor so drunk that I must be interpreted like an Araxi Island man.
His face drooped a little.
Nevertheless, Alvarez is not wrong.
Will there ever be another war? Morgan asked.
Oh, I rather think so, said Astrian,
Men do not manage well with too much peace. Someone will find a quarra.
I can only pray that you're right, said Morgan.
Ha! Look at those beauties, a pair of ale wagons. This pot is mine.
He swept the coins toward him, but one slid off the chest and onto the dark ground. He got down on his knees to search for it.
To be honest, Highness, I grow a little bored with dicing, said Astrian.
Of course you do, now that I am beginning to win my money back.
Morgan straightened up in triumph, the wayward coin in his fist.
What else have we to do in any case?
It must be rising midnight, and you told me the wine is all gone.
Perhaps, said Astrian.
Perhaps,
Morgan grimaced.
Anything but yes has an ugly sound, for I could happily drink more.
Sir Porto stirred.
I marvel at your stomach, young master. It must be from your mother's side. Your late father, I recall, never drank anything stronger than the weakest, most watered wine.
His eyes widened in distress.
Oh, Highness, forgive me. I forgot what day it is. Fool, said Alvarez.
Morgan shook his head as though in anger, but said,
Don't chide old Porto. What should I care? The dead are dead. It does no good to think on them too much.
Porto still looked shaken, but now a little surprised as well.
Ah, but I am sure he watches you from heaven, Prince Morgan. If it were me.
He fell silent, caught up by a sudden thought of his own.
Only you could so deftly crush a conversation, ancient fool,
Astrian told him.
We speak of wine, then you chime in with death and heaven, the two chief foes of a man's drinking pleasure.
Morgan shook his head again.
I said leave him be, both of you. If my father is watching over me, it would be the first time. No, truly. I will tell you a story. Once, when I was but young, I went to his chambers to tell him I had saddled and rode my horse all by myself. When he came to the door, he said I must tell my master he was not to be disturbed.
I do not understand, said Porto, frowning.
He thought I was some page boy sent by Count Aelair.
Morgan smiled at the joke, but did not seem to find it truly funny.
Perhaps he had the sun in his eyes, Porto said. I'm all but blind when the sun shines in my face.
It wasn't the first time he did not know his own son, nor the last.
Morgan looked down for a moment, then turned to Astrian.
We were talking about wine. Why? Do we have some left, after all?
Sir Astrian smiled.
As it happens, a few local girls we met promised they would meet us tonight in the birch grove at the edge of the field. I told them if they brought wine, they might even meet the true prince of all Ostenard.
For a moment, Morgan brightened, but then an unhappy shadow passed over his face.
I can't do it, Astrian.
My grandparents want to be ready to ride into Hernisadark tomorrow morning, as soon as the invitation is received. They told me to be in my tent by the end of the second watch.
They want you rested, am I not right? So you may present yourself to the Hernisteri as befits a prince.
I suppose.
Then what do you think would be better? To go sourly and soberly to bed after I have finished taking more money from you? Or to have an enjoyable time with some local wenches, and to wet your dry throat enough to allow you a happy, peaceful sleep.
Morgan laughed despite himself.
By God, you could argue the ransomer down off the holy tree, Astrian. Well, perhaps I will go along for a little while then. But you must promise to help me get back to the royal tents. My grandfather is already furious with me.
He made a face.
He had adventures. He slew dragons. But what does he expect of me?
endless, horrid ceremonies. Sitting still all day while fools drone on about justice and taxes and hides of land, like the buzzing of bees on a hot day. It is enough to send anyone to sleep, whether they have drunk any wine or not.
He stood, brushing the worst of the dry grass and dirt from his clothes, although it was hard to tell by lamplight whether he had improved his appearance much. The sleeve of his jerkin had a woeful tatter, and the knees of his hose were both now damp and darkened with mud.
"Alvarez? Porter? Are you coming?"
Alvarez appeared suddenly from the shadows like something lifted from a box. Porto only shook his head.
"I am too old for this foolishness, night after night," he said. "I will remain here and think about my soul."
"That is the part of you least worth exercising, old man."
Astrian rose and stretched.
"And now, Highness, if you'll follow me, I believe some ladies await us."
"It amazes me how such a short fellow cuts such a figure with the women," the prince said, looking on his friend with more than a little pride.
"Huh," said Alvarez, looking down at the prince, who was in truth less than a handspan taller than Sir Astrian. "I see two short fellows."
"Silence, beanpole," said Morgan.
"There is no need for amazement, Highness," Astrian was grinning. "As with sword play, the weapon must only be well employed and long enough to reach its target."
He made a mocking bow and swaggered out, pointedly leaving Prince Morgan and Sir Alvarez to follow him. After they had gone, Porto rose with a series of pained grunts and began to look around in case someone had left something to drink. After long moments of fruitless search, he sighed, then followed his comrades out between the tents and toward the distant birch grove. The prince knew he had waved to the guards standing watch. That much was certain. Everything had been fine up until then. But now he seemed caught like a fish in a net, and it had happened quite by surprise. He was having a particularly difficult time with tent flaps today. That much, at least, was beyond argument. Morgan pawed at the heavy cloth, turning, trying to find the edge. No luck. He took another step forward, but now there seemed to be fabric on both sides of him. What madman would make a tent with two flaps? And when had they substituted it for the perfectly good tent he'd already had? The prince cursed and pawed again, then picked up as much of the flap as he could reach, and lifted it, staggering forward with the weight of the heavy fabric on his head and shoulders. The stars appeared above him. For just a brief moment he wondered why there were stars inside his tent, but then realized that he had somehow worked his way back outside. He had an overwhelming need to piss, so he undid his breeks and sent forth a mighty stream. He watched it feather in the stiff breeze until it dwindled and died. He decided he should try the flap again.
"Ah, yes, I have been drinking."
It explained a great deal.
This time he solved the puzzle after only a short interval of grunting and fumbling, and made it two steps into the tent before he smashed his shin against some obstacle.
The pain was so fierce that he was still hopping on one foot, swearing like a Merrimond riverman, when somebody flipped open a hooded lantern, bathing the interior of the tent in light.
"Where have you been?" demanded his grandmother, the queen.
Morgan almost fell down before remembering 2 feet on the ground made for better balance. The shock of the sudden light and Queen Miriamel's voice had not yet passed, when she added,
"And what are you thinking, child? Fasten your clothes, please."
He scrabbled to pull his breeks closed. Drink had made his fingers as clumsy as raw sausages.
Majesty, oh, for the love of all that is good, sit down before you trip on something else and kill yourself."
He sank onto the chest that had so recently and cruelly attacked him. His shin still throbbed.
Am I... Is this... I thought... Yes, you young fool, this is your tent. I was waiting for you. God, you are stinking drunk. And stinking is the word.
He tried to smile, but it didn't feel like he was getting it right.
Not my fault. Astrian. Astrian challenged Baron Kolfer's men to contest.
For a long time, Morgan had thought that the man he was matching cup for cup was Baron Kolfer himself. He had been surprised that the Baron was so young and so muscular, and that he had the Holy Tree tattooed on his forehead. It hadn't been until Morgan had fallen to his knees vomiting, and the Baron's men had been cheering loudly for someone called Ox, that he had realized the Baron himself was not present. He wouldn't have felt so bad at this moment if he had managed to win. That would have made the scolding worthwhile.
You have no idea how lucky you are that it was me waiting for you, not your grandfather. He already thinks you are becoming an embarrassment.
Not an embarrassment. I'm a prince.
His grandmother rolled her eyes to the heavens.
Oh, spare me. Is this what a prince does to honor the day of his father's birth? Drinks until the morning hours? Stumbles back in, half-dressed, smelling of vomit and cheap sachet? Could you not at least spend your time with women who can afford a decent pomander? You stink like the end of market day.
Yes, there had been a few girls. He remembered that now. He and Astrian had been walking them back to their village for their protection. Olveris was off protecting an older woman he'd met. But then things had become a bit confusing, as the walk turned into a game of hide-and-seek. Then there had been wet grass. Somebody had been named Sofra, he thought. A very friendly someone. After that, he had been back in camp, trying to get past the demon tent flap, waiting for his lazy squire to wake up and help him. Which reminded him,
"Where's Melkin?" "If you mean your squire, I sent him out a short while ago to get me a blanket. A clean blanket. I didn't expect to be waiting so long, and I was getting cold."
She sounded very, very unhappy.
"Please, Majesty, Grandmother, I know you're angry, but I can explain."
Queen Miriamel rose.
"There is nothing to explain, Morgan. There is nothing interesting or unusual about anything you have been doing, except for the fact that you are heir to the High Throne."
She moved to the tent flap.
"We will only be a day or two in Hani Sadak, where the people are already whispering about you and your friends, I am told. Then we must travel to Elvrit's Hala in Rimmersgard to say farewell to one of the finest men your grandfather and I have ever known. You will not simply be a visitor there. You will be all they will see and remember for years of the man who will one day lead them. The man to whom even the King of Hernestia and the Duke of Rimmersgard must kneel. Will you make yourself an ugly joke, as you have done in Urchester, and all during this journey? Will you earn the people's loyalty or their scorn?"
She flipped shut the hood on the lantern, leaving only her voice to share the darkened tent with him.
"We leave early tomorrow. Iskrimnor still lives, but for how long, no one knows. You will be on your horse at first light. If you are timely and presentable, I will not tell your grandfather about this. Remember, first light."
Morgan groaned despite himself.
"Too early? Why so early?"
He tried to remember what Astrian had said, because it had made sense at the time.
"I only drank wine so I could sleep better, and not... I mean, so I could be a good prince, a better prince."
There was a long silence. The queen's voice was cold as a blade.
Your grandfather and I are tired of this foolishness, Morgan. Very, very tired.
The queen seemed to have no trouble with the flap, passing through and out into the night without a sound. Morgan sat on the chest in darkness and wondered why things were always so much easier for everyone else.
3. Conversation with a Corpse Giant. The waxing moon was nearly full, but curtained by thick clouds, as were the stars. It was not hard for Yarnulf to imagine that he was floating in the high darkness where only God lived, like a confessor priest in his blind box, listening all day long to the sins of mankind. But God, he thought, did not have that corpse smell in his nostrils every moment. Or did he? For if my lord doesn't like the scent of death, Yarnulf wondered, why does he make so many dead men? Yarnulf looked to the corpse stretched to the side of the tree burial platform nearest the trunk. It was an old woman, or had been, her hands gnarled like tree roots by years of hard work, her body covered only by a thin blanket, as though for a summer night's sleep instead of eternity. Her jaw was bound shut, and snow had pooled in the sockets of her eyes, giving her a look of infinite, blind blankness. Here in the far north of Rimmersgard, they might worship at the altar of the new god and his son, Usiris Aiden, but they honored the old gods and old ways as well. The corpse wore thick birch bark shoes, which showed she had been dressed not for a triumphal appearance in Usiris the Ransomer's heavenly court, but for the long walk through the cold, silent land of the dead. It seemed barbaric to leave a body to scavengers and the elements, but the Rimmer's folk who lived beside this ancient forest considered it as natural as the southerners setting their dead in little houses of stone or burying them in holes. But it was not the local customs that interested Yarnulf, or even what waited for the dead woman's soul in the afterlife, but the scavengers who would come to the corpse, one sort in particular. The wind strengthened and set clouds flowing through the black sky, the treetop swaying. The platform on which Yarnulf sat, 30 cubits above the icy ground, rocked like a small boat on rough seas. He pulled his cloak tighter and waited. He heard it before he could see anything, a swish of branches out of time with the rise and fall of the wind's noises. The scent came to him a few moments later, and although the corpse lying at the far end of the platform had an odor of its own, it seemed almost healthy to Yarnulf, matched against this new stink. He was almost grateful when the wind changed direction, although for a moment it left him with no way of judging the approach of the thing he had been waiting for since the dark northern afternoon had ended. Now he saw it, or at least part of it, a gleam of long, pale limbs in the nearby treetops. As he had hoped, it was a corpse giant, a hooney, too small or too old to hunt successfully, and thus reduced to preying on carcasses, both animal and human. The sinking moon still spread enough light to show the creature's long legs flexing and extending as it clambered toward him through the treetops like a huge white spider. Yarnulf took a slow, deep breath and wondered again whether he would regret leaving his bow and quiver down below, but carrying them would have made the climb more difficult, and even several arrows would not kill a giant quickly enough to be much use on such a dangerously constrained battlefield, especially when his task was not to kill the creature, but to get answers from it. He was frightened, of course. Anyone who was not a madman would be. So he said the monk's night prayer, which had been one of Father's favorites. Aiden to my right hand, Aiden to my left. Aiden before me, Aiden behind me.
Aiden in the wind and rain that fall upon me. Aiden in the sun and moon that light my way. Aiden in every eye that beholds me and every ear that hears me.